Welcome to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from March 23rd, 2000.
From the high deserts in the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening and or good morning. Actually, stretching from the Tahitian and Hawaiian Islands in the west, eastward to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands, south all the way to McMurdo Station in the Antarctic, north all the way to the pole, and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM. Good morning. Boy, do I have an unusual event for you. You know the gigantic iceberg? Well, it calved, which means it broke off. So if you didn't see the photo yesterday, you're going to want to see it now. The iceberg, here it is, an iceberg about twice the size of Delaware has broken off from the Ross Ice Shelf in Antarctica and could drift into shipping lanes around the South Polar region. Get this, folks, the elongated iceberg detected by satellites measures 183 miles by 22 miles and is among the largest ever observed, according to the National Science Foundation. Scientists estimate the iceberg surface area is about 4,247 square miles compared to Delaware at 1,932 square miles. Holy moly. And now I get this email from, guess where, McMurdo Station in the Antarctic. I couldn't believe it. It says, hi, Art. Now you can say you're heard all the way to Antarctica. I don't get to listen often, but when I get the chance, it's nice to hear live radio. I've listened since my days in Mount Shasta when the Reno station, that would be KOH, was the only one I could get in. Maybe someday I'll get around to calling and saying hi. And, of course, the return address is McMurdo.gov and McMurdo Station in the Antarctic. And guess what, folks? I said, yeah, call. Do it before the show, and we'll see if we can get you on. And so this, I believe, is a commercial first coming up here in a moment, if we can do it. I've got Mike. I've got Mike at McMurdo on the line down in the Antarctic. You ought to see the new photos on my website, by the way. We've got the links up of the break of this incredible iceberg. It's really an amazing photograph, an amazing occurrence. In a moment, if we're lucky, Mike from Antarctica, specifically McMurdo Station. Stay right there. Well, all right, if we can do this, it's going to be a commercial radio first, I do believe. Ladies and gentlemen, here, let's give it a try. We're going all the way to Antarctica, to McMurdo Station at Antarctica. And, Mike, are you there?
I'm here.
Mike, what are you doing down there?
Well, right now I am enjoying sitting down after my shift as chef of McMurdo Station.
You are the chef at McMurdo.
I am.
You are a very, very important person then.
Well, I like to think so.
Well, as a matter of fact, if something were to happen to you, I imagine a lot of those scientists would be starving.
Well, actually, we have quite a few cooks. There's about 200 people spending the winter here this winter. It's a higher population than normal. But I've got six cooks working with me that make sure everybody gets fed. So there, any one of them could easily fill my shoes.
What kind of food does somebody who is at McMurdo for the duration generally eat? Do you guys eat well?
We do. I must say that the staff is really talented, and because folks are working really hard in some really extreme conditions, that they're pretty well taken care of.
Well,
it runs the gamut. If you can think of it, we've probably made it at some point for these folks.
Huh. Well, listen, I saw a really good movie with Steven Seagal, I believe, in which he said, listen, I'm only a chef. Do you guys get movies down there?
We do. We have some videos available for us to borrow from the little store we have down here. And there's also the Armed Forces broadcasting networks. We've got Armed Forces Radio,
of course.
Armed Forces Television. So we have that.
Okay, how far east is McMurdo from Little America?
Yeah, I hate to profess my ignorance before so many listeners, but I'm not even sure where Little America is.
Okay, it's to the west of you, almost directly to the west of you. And you told me before we went on the air, somehow you got through on one of my 800 lines. I sat here thinking the international line, and that's what I sent. And then I thought, oh, God, maybe he won't get through on the international line. And then I started to try to think whether you were east or west of the Rockies. And I couldn't figure that out. I didn't know what to say.
Well, the most direct route would be west. If you were to fly from the west coast to New Zealand, which is what those of us at McMurdo have done, they bring us in through Christchurch, where we're issued all of our cold weather gear and get a little bit of cold weather information. And then it's about 2,400 nautical miles southeast from New Zealand to McMurdo.
Yikes.
So we're still west of the west coast of the U.S.
What kind of instructions do they give you when you're on the way to McMurdo about cold weather? What do they tell you?
Well, the most important thing that we get for down here is drink lots of water. Not only is McMurdo Antarctica, the coldest continent, it's also the driest. It is desert here, and dehydration just really aggravates any of the other things you might be suffering from because of the cold.
Did you say desert?
Yes.
Now, most people, we've got a little delay here. Most people think of Antarctica as all ice.
It is. Oddly enough, 70% of the world's fresh water is here beneath our feet, but it's accumulated over hundreds of thousands of years.
By the way, most of us here would just assume that it remain ice.
Exactly.
We're a little concerned about that.
From the looks of things, there's not much to worry about. Today's about the second or third day of autumn down here, and we're pushing minus 60 wind chill tonight. So
minus 60 already?
It should stay nice and frozen for you.
Uh-huh. It's just now a few days into fall, and you say it's minus 60 wind chill already. What is the coldest it would generally get during the darkness of winter?
Well, I've been here since August. I got here just past first sunrise about 7 months ago. And the coldest I've seen since then is about 100 below wind chill. And it doesn't stay like that all the time. You know, it's as the wind gusts, it'll get colder. I'm told, you know, minus 60 to minus 80 ambient is probably as low as we're going to see here. We are on the coast, as it were, so we're not as extreme as the pole.
Without the proper protection in the minus 100 category, how long would you survive before your skin froze?
I don't have any actual statistics, but I would think not much more than several minutes. It's the sort of thing where after a while your body adapts, and you know, only today did I start to layer my clothing for the walk across base to work. Your body is used to kind of the sub-zero temperatures.
Huh.
So the body's also really resilient, but you don't want to stay out very long like that.
Okay, I've been watching the I've got a map here which shows where the sun is relative to McMurdo. And, you know, it doesn't look like it's moving to me. I'm used to seeing the sun move, the gray area and then the darkness from the light move, and it's not moving. I'm pretty sure my computer's working just fine. So it must be that it moves a little bit, throwing you into light for part of the day and then into darkness. How does that work?
Right. The time scale of light and darkness down here is very different. When I got here, I mentioned that it was just after the first sunrise, so there was only a few minutes of direct sunlight and a few hours of twilight back in August. By October, we were into 24 hours of sunlight, just all day, all night, sunlight all the time. And in February, we had our first sunset, so now the days have been getting shorter. So from 24 hours of daylight on February 23rd, we are now to 12 hours of light, 12 hours of dark.
Well, here's another question for you. There was a lady who had a medical problem, I believe, there last year, and they were saying that for part of the year, they really cannot get to you. In other words, no matter what happens, you guys are closed off from the rest of the world, period. Is that true?
That's why they think those of us that choose to spend the winter here are a bit nuts.
Well, I was going to ask that question a little further down line.
at the end of February, the last of the summer folks left, and a few of us went outside to wave at the plane as it went by, and there will be nothing coming this way till August. So it's a matter of you use your smarts and you stay safe till then, because things can happen very quickly here. The conditions are very extreme, and if you get a little careless, if you try to break some of the rules that they have in place for your safety, death is a real possibility. People have died here, and there's nowhere to go until August.
Then your life support systems have got to be really good ones, and I'm sure very redundant. What kind of buildings are you in?
We're actually in buildings that remind me of a military base, or, I was born and raised in Pennsylvania, and it looks to me often like a kind of a Pennsylvania mining town. Just very, very plain buildings, very functional. It was largely built in the 50s by the U.S. Navy. It was originally a U.S. naval station.
Uh-huh.
So it's that government look. It's got some Quonset huts, some dormitory-looking buildings.
Do they retain the heat pretty well?
Yes, everything's really well insulated.
I would imagine. All right, let's get to the how come you're not crazy part. Going down there to a place where you can't come back. There is no plane. There is no train. There is nothing. You're just plain there, as you say, until August. Why would a person choose to do that, Mike?
Well, I think everybody has his own reasons. But what I've noticed of the folks that I've met down here, most places I've lived, I've been kind of the oddball, the one that likes to see everything and do everything. And what you find down here is all of those people from all over show up here, because it's just one of those very special places. It's one of the most beautiful places you could ever imagine. It's very, very rare to get a chance to come to a place like this, and we're all very honored at the fact that we were chosen in our various fields to be a part of the U.S. Antarctic program.
Of course.
And to get to come to this place where very few people that have ever been on the planet have gotten to come.
Indeed. I'm looking at McMurdo, and it looks like it's very close to the ocean. How close are you?
Not quite spitting distance, but I can see the open water from where I'm speaking to you right now.
You can see the open water?
Right.
Wow.
And the open water, what we call the ice edge, is where the open water meets the ice, is a very fluid thing. And this time of year, as the ocean is beginning to refreeze, and I'll tell you, that's something to watch, is when one day you look outside and the ocean's liquid, and the next day you look outside and it's solid. It kind of drives home where you're at.
Does it get solid enough to walk on?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I believe you were in the Air Force at one point, weren't you?
That's right.
You know a bit about aircraft.
Yes.
The seasonal ice right here by McMurdo, I mentioned that the Ross Ice Shelf itself, the permanent ice, is just about 2 miles down the road.
2 miles.
And that's where it's 300 feet thick, and that part doesn't really melt away seasonally. But where we're at is traditionally the point where the water comes to, which is why all of the early explorers chose this spot to embark. The seasonal ice will get to be about 6 to 8 feet thick, I'm told, and believe it or not, they, this past summer, landed a fully loaded C-5.
On that ice? Tank. Oh, my goodness.
On a 6 feet thick piece of ice.
How far out does the ice freeze from the shore, eventually, or in the dead of winter? How far out does it go?
Well, I'm not sure if you're aware, but McMurdo is actually on Ross Island, which is an island just off the coast. I can see the continent of Antarctica from this same window I'm looking at right now, and it's just across the water. But it will freeze solid between the island and the continent. And the seasonal ice will go for hundreds of miles. It will break up each year.
Hundreds of miles. My God.
Yes.
So, yes, I see the water in between you and the continent itself, and I can see that you would probably be able to look out your window and see it on a good, clear day.
Right. The area between the island and the coast of the continent freezes solid. That's where they set up the seasonal runway and land those planes. This time of year, actually when they had, were still having flights, they move it down over onto the permanent shelf just to make sure. But yeah, for most of the summer, the planes were landing on what I'm looking at now is open water.
All right. Well, you know, of course, or I'm sure you know, because you sent me some of the links, that a big part of you, or the Ross Ice Shelf, I mean a really big part, just actually last night they were showing us satellite pictures of the crack, you know, the fissure. And then today I got on the net, and bingo, this gigantic piece, 183 miles by 22 miles, broke off from the Ross Ice Shelf. Is that right?
Yeah, it's about the size of Connecticut, they tell me.
Connecticut. Actually, 4,247 square miles. That's a really, really big piece of ice.
Yes, it is.
What's likely to happen? Is it going to? Is it moving away now, or will it kind of stay with you for a little while, or what happens?
Well, it's about 200 miles from here, from what I read in that same press release, the National Science Foundation, you know, emailed all of us down here so we know what's going on.
Right.
You don't know. There's folks that are doing some computer modeling right now trying to estimate where this is going to go. And I'm sure it depends on weather conditions, because which way the wind is blowing and the currents are going have a lot to do with that. I guess there is some possibility it could flow this way, or it could break up some before it goes out to sea. At this point, it just broke off, and as far as I know, they're still waiting to see what it chooses to do.
I wonder if there were any scientists dispatched from McMurdo or elsewhere, of course it's a whole international area you're in, to observe the breakaway of the calving of this thing, and there that must have been some cracking sound when it went.
Yeah, I'm not aware of anyone over there. Tell you, no one left from McMurdo, because again, we're closed off for the season. There's nobody coming or going
season
from
closed.
This part of the continent. And there might have been somebody at a base closer over there, but really, with the weather the way it is, you know, 40 knot winds and you know, minus 60 wind chills, travel by any means is pretty risky. So I would imagine they just use their satellites. But again,
if you had to travel, Mike, what kind of vehicle would they use to travel?
Well, hey, we have all kinds of things. I may be a very fortunate person indeed. If the weather clears up by this weekend, I might get to take a snowmobile trip up to Mount Erebus, which is a volcano which shares the island with us. I'm not sure if you knew about that.
An active volcano?
Yes, it's not spewing lava at this point, but they have researchers up there watching the fumaroles.
All right, Mike, hold on. Stay right where you are. We'll be right back. That's Mike at McMurdo Station in Antarctica. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast and Beyond AM.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from March 23rd, 2000. You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from March 23rd, 2000.
It certainly is. I'm Art Bell, and we are, I believe, doing a commercial radio first. We're talking to Mike at McMurdo Station at Antarctica. Absolutely incredible, and hopefully he's still there. We'll get back to him in a moment. Mike at McMurdo Station, down at the very bottom, and I mean the very bottom of the world. Get your globe out and take a look. Well, all right, I guess, once again, a commercial radio first. We've got Mike, who is the chef at McMurdo Station at Antarctica. And I think he's still on the line. Are you there, Mike?
I'm still here.
All right. This is absolutely amazing. Another thing that we have all been wondering, and there may not be an answer for it, you're at the bottom of the world, and the satellites that would allow communications are geosynchronous at the equator. And so I can't imagine how you're talking to me, Mike.
Well, I don't understand it myself. I mentioned in my email that in terms of some of the technical parts of the whole situation down here, I'm fairly ignorant. I show up, I make some good food, and go home most days. I try to learn what I can, but things like satellite placement are a bit beyond my scope.
Okay, well, anyway, we're doing it somehow.
Exactly.
And I'm, as you know, a ham operator, and one time I had the pleasure of sitting there and talking to somebody at the North Pole, actually at the North Pole, and down there at Antarctica at the same time. And you know what we were doing? We were swapping T-shirts.
I believe it.
Does the little store that you have there have T-shirts?
They do indeed. That's probably one of their top selling items. We all have family and friends back home, and I think if any of us were to come home without gifts, we might think Antarctica was warm compared to the reception we'd receive.
Is it like Hard Rock Cafe McMurdo or something?
I haven't seen a Hard Rock, but we've got your typical McMurdo Athletic Department kind of T-shirt. We've got one with a... See, I haven't seen it lately. They may have run out. A nice screen print of the volcano.
Well, I'll tell you what. If you can find your way to sending me a T-shirt, not only will I pay for it, but I will wear it on my webcam proudly.
All right.
What's the life like down there? In other words, are there penguins, for example?
Well, the penguins have left. Unfortunately, I didn't get to see them very much.
Well, I don't blame them. Where do they go?
Well, they've got to stay near the open water. And as the ice, the seasonal ice is freezing back up, they've got to follow the ice edge. But even though the ice edge is still here, they've been gone for a couple weeks, it seems. The life is very limited. For a little while over the summer, we will have whales and seals and penguins and some seabirds known as skuas. They're basically, they look a lot like a seagull.
But when the going really gets rough, they go.
The people are the only one crazy enough to stay down here. This is not a place that was designed to support life.
All right, now, this iceberg again, it's big news worldwide right now, and I'm reading in the Associated Press copy of the story that calving of the iceberg has moved the boundary of the Ross Ice Shelf southward about 25 miles.
Right, in that one location. And if you look at a globe or a map, what always amazes me is I've actually spent a night camping out on the ice shelf as part of some field training that I did.
Sounds like fun.
And, yeah, it's, like I said before, there's so many things here that you can do that there's just nowhere else in the world can you camp out on 300 feet thick ice.
Yeah, right.
So I love looking at maps, and when you see just how huge the ice shelf is, it's a big piece of ice. I have no idea what it compares to in terms of states or whatever, but if you look at a map, that half of the area of that little inlet of the Ross Sea is frozen solid all the time, and that's a lot of ice. So in that one corner, the edge moved down about 25 miles, I suppose, but it's something that, in terms of how much ice there is, I don't know, as a percentage of the total ice in the shelf, I would think that would register as kind of small. Although it is a significant event because it's one of the largest ever seen, and things that big tend to get in the way sometimes.
Since you guys have a lot of time on your hands generally down there, do you ever wonder what might be down 300, in other words, you've got 300 feet of ice, and going back through the ages, say 200 or 250 feet down, I wonder what might be there.
Well, that is part of some of the research going on. As I understand it, they do the drilling of the ice cores. There's some camps. I know there's a multinational group that drills ice cores in several locations, and they pack them carefully in cases and keep them frozen, and then they, at various levels, check and see what was going on in the atmosphere and at the surface, because the water in the snow that was falling at the time will reflect, you know, what particulates were around at the time. So that's part of what's going on down here, is looking back like that to see what exactly has been going on.
If you could get all the way down to the 300-foot level, drill that far down, I wonder, have they gone that far?
They've actually gone farther. The 300-foot is just the ice shelf. That's the frozen ocean part, the frozen Ross Sea. That was what would normally be open water, but it's just so darn cold. Excuse me. It was freezing. Now, over the continent itself, the ice is as much as 3 miles thick.
3 miles thick.
Many people aren't aware that the elevation at the surface at the South Pole, where the South Pole Station is over 10,000 feet, and that's elevation because they're sitting on 10,000 feet worth of ice, basically.
You must be one of the favorite guys. Being the chef there would make you, I think, sort of a favorite guy of everybody, wouldn't it?
Well, have you ever cooked for a living?
No.
You're either the hero or the scapegoat. And when you're cooking for 200 people, you're not everybody's hero. The days you make half the base happy, you make the other half unhappy.
Huh.
It's a little easier now. Over the summer, the population stayed at about 800 for the summer months, getting up to about 1,000 when the supply ship came in. But you can never keep everybody happy. So there are days when folks like me. There are days when I'd rather not show my face. Just like any job anywhere, you do your best and you hope you are getting the job done.
Mike, from about now, you said, until August, shortly, nobody will come, nobody will go because they cannot. And so you all are locked in together. Do you all ever get on each other's nerves?
Yes. It hasn't happened so much that I've seen yet this season. We've been together a month and a half, locked in, as it were. But I did arrive during the period known as wind fly. It's the winter fly-in, where it's not officially the main body where everybody is flying in and everything's happening fast. It's more like the end of the winter when the first folks come in to start getting ready for the big onslaught. And when I got here in August, they warned us at our orientation, just stay out of people's way and be really nice, because the stresses of 24 hours of darkness and a great deal of time with a limited population are strong enough.
Yeah.
And then when you drop, a fresh batch of eager people right in the middle of those, the situation can flare. But they choose carefully, and they choose people that are mature and responsible enough to conduct themselves in appropriate manners. And most of the people that I've met down here are pretty adventuresome, fun people. And they've learned in whatever it is they've done before that if you're feeling a little stressed and you need to stay away from people, then you just stay away from people.
And when you have your own time, spare time, other than talking to a talk show host up here, what do you do? You spend time reading books. Are you able to get live television there? Obviously, you can get radio through the Internet, but what about TV, or do you have to watch tapes?
We have the Armed Forces networks. So we have three channels, basically. One's basically a sports channel, one's largely a news channel, and the other combines various programming. But all three of those channels are a combination of all of the commercial networks. Although it's very dated stuff. We don't get much live. I think for some sporting events they try to get us live. I've seen some of the NCAA games on TV around base, but I'm not a big basketball fan, so I haven't really stopped to watch. But I think they, for time-sensitive things like that, they try to keep the AFRTS pretty well updated.
I know AFRTS. So,
we get whatever, you know, we get whatever AFRTS is putting out.
Well, that's pretty good stuff, actually.
Really, it's not so bad, and we do have access to the internet, and I think these days that is probably the best source of information going anyway.
And it's also a very nice way, I guess, to stay in touch with your family and friends.
Exactly, and you can do everything from read your hometown newspaper to you know, listen to your favorite radio show, and you know, that means a lot because we are isolated. The next nearest town is 2,400 miles away.
Oh, my God. 2,400 miles?
Well, there might be one closer, but Christchurch is 2,400 miles. So, you know, it's not like we can, you know, just go over to the neighbor's house. So,
well, let me ask you this. Let me ask you this. There are other nations. It's an international area, I guess, controlled by the UN, and other nations have stations there in the Antarctic. If one of them gets in trouble, or if you get in trouble, can one come to the rescue of the other?
Absolutely. The only station quite near to us is Scott Base, and that's the New Zealand Antarctic Program base. And they have a much smaller program, but they are entirely cooperative with the U.S. program. They only have, I believe it's 9 people spending the winter over there. And, you know, they'll invite us over for dinner. Not all of us, of course, but, you know, they'll take turns and invite a handful of people to come join them for dinner. And they're about 2 miles away.
So so there's a little bit of socializing that goes on.
Yes. It's another way to, I imagine, for them, with only 9 of them, seeing fresh faces is even more important than it is over here. So it's nice, you know, one night a week they'll invite some Americans over to come say hi.
As a matter of curiosity, are you married, Mike?
I'm single.
Single. That's good. When you told your mom and dad, listen, I'm going to go be a chef at McMurdo Station in Antarctica, what did they say to you?
Well, I think mom's face pretty much went blank. I think my family is somewhat used to it. I think Antarctica was a bit of a surprise. I hadn't really told anybody since I was about 8 or 9 years old. I had wanted to come to Antarctica, and I, you know, through friends of friends of friends, I heard about a chance of maybe going there and working. So I thought, great, and I kind of kept it on a back burner. But about 2 years ago at Christmas, I mentioned that hopefully this time next year I'll be in Antarctica, and people were a little surprised, but I think they've stopped being surprised. I'm the sort that, you know, I was living and working in Washington, D.C., and, you know, changed careers and moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico to become a chef, and then moved to Mount Shasta to try something a little different, and then, you know, they've realized that if there's something I really want to do, I'm probably going to pursue it.
Well, how does one go about getting a job down there? I mean, is it like you pick up the newspaper near Mount Shasta and it says, job opening, rare opportunity, come south?
Well, actually, no. Although in the Denver area, it was advertised a little more heavily in the newspapers. We, the civilians here, actually everybody here now is civilian, they work for a government contractor who advertised in a Denver area. I just happened to have a friend who had a landlord who was one of the electricians down here. And as soon as I heard the word Antarctica, I immediately started asking questions and found out what to do. And it took me about a year and a half. It's a pretty rigorous application process. And if you make it through the normal job interview type things and the resume screening and the reference checks, then it begins a you know, a physical screening. You've got to be physically fit to
sure
endure the conditions here. So it's a pretty prolonged process. But about a year and a half later, I was on my way.
What are the accommodations like? For example, as chef, do you have your own room? Do you share a room with somebody, or is it like a barracks?
Well, it's not because I'm chef, but I do have my own room over the winter because the population is smaller over the winter and because they are aware that it's a stressful time of year. Wintering is considered, you know, the difficult time, although
yes.
There's more going on in the summer. The stresses of winter are greater. So folks get their own rooms, and that's nice. In the summertime, we all share rooms.
Do you, for example, in your room, I take it at times the wind really howls down there, doesn't it?
It does. It's also the windiest continent. We are the highest, driest, coldest, and windiest continent on Earth.
So what might be a typical high windstorm for you there?
High, I'm just looking at the Weather Channel here. We're at about 40 knots right now. High, I would imagine, I've seen it as high as 80. And that is when the weather conditions start going down. They have a system here where they have condition 3, condition 2, and condition 1. And condition 3 can be anything from, you know, summertime shorts and t-shirts weather, which for us down here is, you know, 20s and 30s, sunshine and no wind.
Huh.
But today, with 40-knot winds and minus 60 wind chill, we're still at condition 3. So that's a pretty broad condition. Condition 3 is you're pretty much safe going outside. Condition 2 is you can't leave the base without checking out with the emergency services people and taking a radio and taking other people with you. You can't leave alone.
Wow.
Condition 1 is where they actually tie up ropes between the buildings so you can find your way because visibility is zero.
You've got to have ropes between the buildings?
During condition 1, there's no visibility and the winds can blow you off your feet.
So, God.
They give you a rope to hold on to. And that's very rare. I think it's been a couple of years since we've had a condition 1 here at McMurdo.
Of course, when they show a movie about it, it's always condition 1. I've actually seen that where they had ropes between the buildings, because otherwise it really would be possible to get blown around and die trying to get from one building to another.
Sure, or just lost. If the visibility is that poor, and there are times when you can't see from one building to another, if you start walking in the wrong direction, you could be very long in discovering that you're not headed to the building you thought you were.
When you look out your window, other than being able to see the water, is everything white?
It's starting to get that way again. Of course, the buildings are various shades of gray and brown and olive drab. The water can be kind of a grayish blue to a silvery color.
Huh.
The best times, though, are sunsets. And as I mentioned earlier, things happen a little more elongated here. There's, you know, four-month-long days and those four-month-long nights. But this time of year, when the sun is coming up and going down, we get to a point in the year where the sunset will last for 4 or 5 hours.
That's why my screen is moving so slowly here.
It is. And I have an incredible view of the Royal Society Mountain Range, which is a coastal range over on the continent. And at sunset, the colors are magnificent. The pastels of oranges and pinks and purples against the white and the blue. And when the sky is clear, it's incredibly blue.
By the way, how's the ultraviolet there?
That is one of the other survival things they tell us about, is lots of sunscreen.
Lots of sunscreen.
Number
1,000 or something.
Well, I went out for my field safety training, and I was wearing SPF 30, and I obviously didn't put it on often enough because I came back with one of the worst sunburns. Because not only are you getting the UV rays, but everything around you is reflecting it back at you.
That's right. Mike, we're out of time. Bless your heart, all the way from McMurdo Station in Antarctica. I've never done this before, a commercial first. Mike, thank you.
You're very welcome, Mike.
And good morning. We'll be right back. Wow, all the way from Antarctica.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from March 23rd, 2000. Networks presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired March 23rd, 2000.
Top of the morning, everybody. I don't think anybody's ever done that before. The first commercial interview, it wasn't really commercial. Well, I guess it was. It's on a commercial program of anybody in Antarctica. That was Mike, who is the chef that we interviewed for the last hour at McMurdo Station in the Antarctic, where from about now through August, nobody comes and nobody goes, because they can't. That was really something. Constantly get new experiences here. All right, well, coming up in a moment, Peter Davenport has a bit of a report for us. And then hanging on very patiently, John Myler is going to come on the air with us. He's a very, very interesting individual who is very religious, but believes they, put that in quotes, they are here. And I don't know how that's going to work out, but we're going to find out shortly. Peter Davenport in a moment. Actually, I've been watching my map here, which shows where the sun is with respect to McMurdo Station, and they are now in the gray area, the small gray zone, so it's getting darker there. And I imagine in a number of hours, at the rate it's moving, it's going to be completely dark as fall and the very, very cold weather closes in, and apparently it's pretty cold. So, anyway, that was really cool. From the Antarctic now to the state of Washington and Peter Davenport. Peter, hi.
Good evening, Art. Good evening. Boy, that was a fascinating program.
Wasn't that something?
I'm still shivering, and I'm from New England, and that sounds like a wonderful place to be. I couldn't help but wonder whether the government might need a UFO investigator down there someday, and it occurred to me that they'd probably accept me immediately.
Well, I can't remember, Peter, whether it was the Antarctic or the Arctic, one of the two, but you remember the movie The Thing?
Oh, yes, I do.
You remember the big circle in the ice? You remember that?
Yeah. You know, we talked about that briefly on a prior program about a month ago or so. I can't help but wonder, Art, that came out, I think, in 50 or perhaps 1951.
Right.
And it is closely analogous to what happened at Roswell, allegedly. It makes me wonder if that movie was not commissioned by somebody in the government to begin the process of getting the American public accustomed to the notion that we have guests on this planet.
Well, you heard Mike. He said in some areas the ice is 3 miles thick. 3 miles of ice. Now, that's hard to even contemplate, and the bottom of that ice must be about how old?
God only knows. Thousands of years, at least, I would say. And I couldn't help but wonder, while he was saying that, how many Martian or lunar meteors or meteorites
might
be embedded in that ice. As I recall, that's where that Martian meteorite was found that had the tiny little tubules on it. What was it, about 7 or 8 or 9 years ago that news hit the papers? And boy, would it be fun to go hunting for meteorites down there.
Oh, yeah. I'm also thinking of taking the Bell family flag down and planting it on the piece of ice that just broke off, and I'm going to call it Iceville and sell quarter-acre lots.
Right.
With quick depreciation.
Boy, that would,
in case of melting.
Yeah, that would be some ride on that that Hummer.
Anyway, listen, we've got some biz to do. What's going on in the world?
Oh, boy, there are all sorts of things going on, Art. I don't believe, since I started doing this in July of 94, I don't believe I've seen as many bizarre and patent UFO reports as we have been seeing in recent months. And I don't know how far back I should go to mark the beginning of this, but there are things going on, it seems, every day, interesting reports. When I was on last week, of course, we talked about the interesting sighting over Washington, D.C. on the 3rd of March, Friday night, right scene from the Vietnam Memorial. I'm sure you remember the cut.
I do.
Then we started talking about the events over Arkansas, and pieces are slowly but surely falling in place thanks to all the reports that are coming in, thanks to the fine work that Al Collier and Nancy Talbot are doing. Nancy out of Boston, I failed to mention her and her work last time I was on. but they're doing some fine research, and they're going to, they are now having analyzed the strange powder that allegedly was found in some of the craters at the burn site, I guess in the vicinity of Scott or England, Arkansas, which are both east and southeast of Little
White Rock. A white powdery substance.
Yep. And there was also some kind of, they called it magenta powder. I don't know much about colors. I presume magenta is close to purple. What the nature of that was, I don't know. But as a consequence of the program we did last week with that delightful young gal whose name was Jane on the radio and Al Collier, we have gotten a gob of reports from people from Oklahoma, from Kansas, from Missouri, from southwest Arkansas, and just today we got a report from a gentleman who is in Memphis. In fact, if we have time before the bottom of the hour, I'd like to play his the cut I got with this guy. He got a good look at the object at 8:45 or 8:46 that Thursday night. This is just 2 weeks ago, the 9th of March again. And he asserts, and he had a very good look at this object, that the object he saw slowed down and then momentarily dimmed, and then it brightened up considerably to brighter than it had been when he first saw it,
right,
and it accelerated to the north. And we now have evidence that there were at least four, and I'm beginning to think now, perhaps five aerial events between 8 p.m. that Thursday night and 11:45. 8:26 seen from Derby. I may have erred on the time when I reported that last week. It was 8:26, not 8:46, I believe. Then 8:46, 20 minutes later, 10 o'clock and 11:45. To the best of my... And also, we just got a fascinating written report from a couple. They live just 4 miles south of the Missouri border, who are standing outside looking at the night sky at about 7 minutes past 10. And the whole area lit up, much the way Jane described it last week. It turned silver, not green. The trees weren't green. They were silver.
Wow.
That is bright light.
Yes, it is.
And the objects they reported, and this report, this written report, will be on our website probably sometime Saturday, 2 days from now. We will be posting all the new reports that have come in. This couple asserts that the first object that caused the gigantic flash stopped, and it had something surrounding it that they were unable to describe really adequately, and shortly after the first one stopped, a second one stopped.
Huh.
Now, as you know, I try to stick to facts. That's my style. That's my training. But it occurred to me after our program last week, we've had two now seemingly clusters of sightings, the one over Washington, D.C., and then this cluster of sightings over Arkansas. I don't know what it means. I don't know if there's any significance to it, if someone is trying to tell us something. But it does seem ironic, perhaps noteworthy, a little more than that, that the object would appear, the first object on the 3rd of March would appear in the vicinity of the White House. How far away, we don't know. Again, I emphasize that it was only one report, one witness in the case of the sighting over Washington, D.C. on the 3rd of March.
They're probably concerned about the sad state of the elections. Listen, if you have any cuts, let's do them.
Let me play a short cut. This is the gentleman from Memphis, Tennessee, who was driving on the evening of the 9th of March, and this is what he had to report to me just this morning.
Five p.m. I was going to work. I was going west on Goodman Road. I saw this orange red fireball just going right under. It looked like it's going, I don't know, probably 1,000 miles an hour. Not real, real, real fast, but pretty good speed.
Mm-hmm.
And it had at the top of it, it had a real, real bright white light. I mean, real bright white light. Just seemed like it. Everything around it was brightened because of that white light at the front of it.
Uh-huh.
And then it had a pretty good sized tail on the end of it. And it was going, like I say, from the south to the north. And it wasn't going at a downward angle. It was sort of going at an upward angle when I saw it. And as it was going sort of away from me, the light just seemed like it dimmed out. The white light dimmed out.
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell also that it wasn't bright around it like it was, but it was still there because I could see it.
Uh-huh.
And then suddenly the light, it slowed down. The light then come back on again, got real, real bright, and then it left.
Wow.
It wasn't until it slowed down, and then the light got dim.
Uh-huh.
And then when it picked back up, the light come back on again. Accelerate, that's correct, yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. It accelerated.
Accelerated, not behavior of a meteor.
Not at all. Not at all. And we're getting this report from a number of witnesses.
What could it be?
Yeah. They're certainly not meteors. It's not consistent with meteors. Their appearances were not consistent with meteors. You may recall 9 days ago when we had Jane on, she said it was a red fireball and there were tentacles coming out of it. She
right.
described it like a World War II mine with knobs on the surface of
right.
it. Now, we have so many reports now, they're coming out of our ears. A trucker reported from just north of the Red River, which forms the border between Arkansas and Texas down in the southwest corner of Arkansas.
Right.
He was driving north. He was just a mile north of the river. He described very elegantly what he saw as well. It was the same object, I believe, as the one we just heard described. And he said, it's like nothing he's ever seen in his life. It came from behind him. So it was southern Arkansas. And it overtook him very rapidly. He saw it for just a few seconds. It went streaking across the northern horizon, reached the horizon, disappeared from his sight. Well, that by itself is not uncharacteristic of a fireball, a meteorite, or a meteor. But he said it was too slow to be a meteor, in his opinion, and it looked funny. And he said he's seen many meteors in his life. The interesting thing is that almost all of the people who are reporting these things do not report that the object fragmented. Traditionally, a dramatic meteor, when it gets within 15 miles of the surface of the Earth, will fragment.
Sure.
Because the atmosphere is very dense, and the forces that rock encounters when it's doing 10, 20, 30, or 40 miles per second are immense. So it just is like a snowball hitting a brick wall. And only one guy says he thinks that there might have been a fragmentation event, but everybody else says that the object just winked out or went sailing over the horizon. Nobody has reported a sonic boom. That by itself does not rule out a meteor, but it does seem unusual given the fact that this was a dramatic event and the fact that people report that it slowed down And then sped up.
Took off. Oh, yeah. Very weird. All right. If you have one more cut, we might have time for it.
Yeah. Let me go up to Calgary, Alberta. This is a very interesting cut. I'll play just about a minute and then come back online. This is a gentleman last Friday morning, 5:10 a.m., Calgary, Alberta. He saw a cluster of about 20 yellow lights in a V formation go over his city. Here we go.
All right.
At about 5:15, I'm standing at the kitchen window, facing due east. My house is parallel to the Deerfoot Highway,
mm-hmm.
which runs north and south in Calgary.
Mm-hmm.
I can see to my left almost all the way up to the Calgary International Airport, which is about 10 to 15 miles from here.
Uh-huh.
And I can see almost all the way to the south end of Calgary to the right, which is the way the Deerfoot runs north and south. Standing by the phone, I'm deleting some phone messages. I look out the window, these lights catch my eye in a large V formation at low level altitude.
Mm-hmm.
There was a black cloud in the background, which made the lights extremely distinctive. Like there was no mistaking them. There was no shadow, no glare off the window. I immediately opened the door, jumped outside in my underwear, stood there watching these, yelled back at my wife, and I said, go to the window, look out the window. And I came back in, and she says, where? And I ran to the other bedroom window, and we followed it, going due south.
Mm-hmm.
They were below the cloud level. They flew too fast for a normal jet. There was no jet noises. Usually when the jets fly here, you can't, there's no mistaking them because they use this area as a circle path. Basically, if you go...
Well, I'll stop it there, Art. But
yeah, we're running out of time. Listen, you're such an indispensable resource. The hotline number up there, folks, is area code 206-722-3000. That's 206-722-3000. If you'd like to make a donation, they operate on donations. Peter operates on donations, not swamp gas. So a few bucks to the address that follows. Write this down, Peter.
The address is the National UFO Reporting Center, P.O. Box 45623, University Station, Seattle, Washington, 98145. That address again, P.O. Box 45623, University Station, Seattle, Washington, and the zip code is 98145.
Bless your heart. And, Peter, the minute you know anything about the mutilations in Oregon, we want it on the air, okay?
I'm searching for data. I'll let you know, Art.
All right. Take care, Peter.
Thank you.
Good night. From the high desert, this is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell. Stand by. We're not done yet.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from March 23rd, 2000. Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from March 23rd, 2000.
It is. Good morning, everybody. Boy, what a wild night already, huh? From the Antarctic, 1 hour of interview, which is priceless, as far as I'm concerned. And then Peter Davenport with, well, you decide for yourself. A meteor? Well, maybe. But do meteors go on and off likewise? Do they slow down? Do they accelerate? Do they begin to gain altitude? I don't know. I have a real problem with that. Coming up in a moment, somebody who may be able to help us out with all of this, who knows? John Myler was born in Madera, California, and now lives in Fresno. He has distinguished himself with a BS degree, is currently the head of a computer security at the Fresno Air National Guard. While his primary occupation is computer security, and of course the military, he explores his interest in the paranormal as author of works of fiction and nonfiction research. Now, John considers himself to be an open-minded Christian. Very open-minded, holding a unique interpretation of the Bible. His latest book, entitled Aliens in the Bible, a biblical perspective of supernatural entities, realms of existence, and phenomena, is posted for free viewing. It's a free book on his website, he maintains, at www.aliensinthebible.com. The paranormal phenomena he covers in his latest book are divided into three categories: entities, realms, and the phenomena. Entities such as aliens, ghosts, even monsters like Bigfoot, realms which encompasses the various levels of heaven and hell, and phenomena such as PSI, astral projection, and reincarnation, all, he says, are found in the Bible and explained in depth. So, pretty unusual guy coming up next. Well, all right, here is John Mylar. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you for being patient also through all of that, but it's just such a busy time.
Yeah.
John, I did not know a person like you existed. In other words, you're a fairly, you call yourself an open-minded Christian.
Yes.
Okay. Some Christians would criticize and say, yep, so open-minded, his brains fell out.
Mm.
In other words, they don't think that aliens exist, and if aliens or other such phenomena are seen, they represent demons.
Yeah. Well, in some situations, I think they do, but perhaps not all. To anybody that would say something like that, I would say that they have put God and their existence in a box. They've defined everything and classified everything, and they're pretty much comfortable with everything the way it is. But actually, when you read the Bible and you start digging into the meanings of these actual terms that are in there, like hosts and stars and creatures and actually what the nature of heaven is, then you discover that the creation that we live in is a lot more mysterious and unknown than most people have been led to believe.
You believe there is a heaven?
Definitely, definitely.
A hell?
Yes, yes.
Heaven and a hell.
Heaven has a physical nature and a spiritual nature, just like your body. Your body, you live in your physical body, and it's indwelt with a spirit. Well, the earth actually is a realm that has a particular level of glory. At one time, earth was in heaven back during the Garden of Eden, but now earth is a cursed creation, and it has death within it. Well, when you read about heaven in Scripture, you discover that heaven is when you go outside and you look up and you see the stars at night. And that's the heavens, but it's also a spiritual dimension to it, that each star has a particular level of glory that describes its presence to God.
Well, we also know there are glorious planets going around a lot of these glorious stars now.
Yeah.
And so modern science, for the most part, says, look, the odds are way out in favor of there being life elsewhere.
Mm.
Elsewhere other than Earth, other planets that harbor intelligent life, that the numbers dictate it almost has to be true. Now, would these be God's creatures, or would there be other creators?
Okay, well, when you read in Genesis 6, the Elohim that said, let there be light, is the Elohim that created all life. He's God, and I will not ever confuse him with any created beings.
All life on earth?
Yes, all life on earth and all life in the universe, all life in the heavens. He's the creator.
But it didn't really ever say in the Bible that there was life anywhere else other than Earth, or did it?
Yeah, it did.
Where?
Just take a simple term, hosts of heaven.
Hosts?
Right there. The term hosts is used to describe people and animals and angels.
Okay, but aren't we confusing heaven with the heavens?
Same thing.
Is it really?
Yeah, see, the heavens is talking about outer space and stars and such.
What we see it on a good clear night.
Yeah.
Yes.
In Genesis 1:15-18 and Exodus 32:13 describes heaven as a physical location. But God's dwelling, it's also considered God's dwelling when you look in Genesis 28:12-13, Psalm 11:4, Matthew 6:9. So heaven is a spiritual and a physical place, but they're both one and the same, just like your spirit dwells within your body.
Well, is that kind of like saying then that everything that is, including the space we know as Earth, is part of heaven?
Yes, that is true. So when you read that term, hosts of heaven, or the stars of heaven, stars and hosts both refer to entities. And so when you read that term, it's simply telling you right there in that short three-word term, hosts of heaven, that there are beings that live within heaven. And when you understand heaven to be outer space within various levels of glory, then you got it all put together.
Huh. But what seems to be described in Genesis, though, is a creation only of Earth, not of all else that is, but just of Earth itself. Let's
well,
be light,
no,
light
no.
On Earth.
And on starting on the third day, that's when God created the stars, and actually it's the fourth day when God created the stars and filled all of His creation with life. So. I mean, the stars and the planets and the moon and the sun and all that, they're all in there, part of that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. So you believe that there could be, that in fact there are aliens. Do you believe that, you know, in other words, aliens, class them as you will, we're talking about a very broad term here, whether we're talking about other dimensions or creatures from other planets in other systems. Do you believe that all of these reports, Peter Davenport detailed just a few, we get them all the time, of these incredible craft flitting about, doing things that our craft cannot do, clearly. Even in space, our shuttles see things that just cannot be.
Well,
only they are.
Some of them are and some of them aren't. I mean, I've heard of holographic technology from satellites and such, and I do believe that there's a lot of things going on. There's a big mixed bag full of phenomenon going on, and it's all classified under the header UFO. But I do believe that there are beings out there, and the Bible seems to indicate that in the latter days that there's going to be an increase of this sort of phenomenon going on, especially as it concerns the arrival of the Antichrist and the end times scenarios.
There are quite a few people who believe, John, that the Antichrist is now alive on Earth. Are you one of those?
Yes, I am. And I believe that because I've studied prophecy long enough to see all the signs. You know, just like you can tell the weather, as Jesus said, you should be able to know that the time is near, and that's what I see. It's pretty clear to me.
And you think the time is pretty near?
Yeah. My assessment of that, I'm not going to set a date or anything. I personally believe it's going to be within my lifetime that all of these things are going to unfold, but I'm not going to argue with anybody about that. Or
Michael will blow the horn and that's it, huh?
Right.
Okay.
That's what I think.
Yep, all right. What do you think about, there's all kinds of categories. I'm on your website, by the way, and we've got a link to your website. So, folks, you can go straight to my website and just go down to the guest area and look for the name John Myler and go over to his website. A number of categories are here. And I am, and always have been, extremely interested in ghosts.
Ghosts.
I do, I don't know, two or three times a year, what I call ghost to ghost, and I just take ghost stories for 5 hours straight on the show, and there's never a shortage. There's always millions of people more who want to talk to me than can ever get through, and the stories that you get, John, are just, have you ever heard one of those?
Oh, yeah.
You have your own.
Yeah.
All right. If you're not a believer that ghosts are something real, after listening to one of those shows, then you're just not listening. And so something is going on. How can a Christian account for the concept of a ghost?
Well, again, the whole concept of exactly what hell is a confusing concept because it has so many descriptions. There's a lowest hell, which is described as a place of burning torment, but then there's a hell that doesn't seem all that bad. It's just a place where there's darkness and sleep. And this to me, and then plus Revelation 20:15-16 describes death and hell as two separate locations. Well, they're actually one and the same, but there are various levels within it. There's an upper, and then all these levels in between, and then the lowest, which is spoken of in Deuteronomy 32:22 and Psalm 86:13.
So there are levels of hell.
Yeah, there are various levels, and I believe that the upper level of hell that it's possible that a spirit could actually remain on the surface. And there is evidence of hauntings even in Scripture.
Wow, so wait a minute now. So you are suggesting that a ghost would be a hellish creature.
Not hellish, but trapped in hell.
All right,
yeah.
At one of the higher levels of hell, not at one of the lower levels of heaven.
Yes.
Woof. Well, then... What does that say, then, John, to all of the people who have called my show, whose relatives have passed on and seem or appear to remain to contact them to let them know things are okay or to let them know to let go that I'm okay? You know, that sort of ghost story, I get an awful lot of that.
Now you're getting into another subject. Now you're talking about...
Maybe I am, but doesn't that mean they're in hell? Upper level, maybe?
Not necessarily. They could have left a part of themselves behind as a thought form. So now you're getting into the subject of thought forms and the power of thought and energy.
As delineated from a ghost.
As delineated from the person when they were alive.
So you could appear then as a ghost...
After you're dead.
As a sort of remnant of yourself, though you have gone to heaven...
Yes.
Or you could appear from one of the upper levels of hell.
Yes. Either or.
How would a person distinguish?
Well, one key thing to keep in mind that I mention in my book is whenever you're analyzing these sort of topics and you come up with different possibilities, that you should always keep a couple of key verses in mind so that you don't fall into deception. And if there's any phenomenon that's purporting some sort of philosophy that's contrary to Scripture, then that gets a big warning flag that jumps up right there. For instance, in Deuteronomy 18:20-22 and Deuteronomy 13:1-4, those are scriptures on how to discern whether a spirit is not from God or not. Or a particular phenomenon.
All right. Well, I'm just a layman, so how would one distinguish?
Okay. this is a touchy subject here with a lot of people because...
So all I do here is touchy stuff.
Yeah. If a spirit is purporting some sort of a doctrine, then I would very much take that into suspect. And if the doctrine is anything contrary to Scripture, then I would definitely believe that it was demonic.
Demonic.
Demonic, yes. The big ugly Christian.
Can you give me an example of what you would consider demonic, something that you would be said to you or...
Okay. If a spirit appears and wants to continue to have an ongoing rapport with someone,
yes,
seems to indicate that that's okay. Well, the Bible clearly indicates that necromancy is a forbidden art. It's something that should not be practiced, and primarily because of demonic influences.
So, in other words, an ongoing dialogue or a request for one.
That would be one indicator, yeah, definitely. Or say if somebody contacted a spirit through a Ouija board. Well, that's a type of necromancy. That's where you're reaching out. And it wouldn't have to be a Ouija board. There's tons of things that are out there, and they're waiting for you to throw sticks on the ground or whatever it may be to reach out to them, and they're on it.
Look, a long time now, John, I've thought, when you even mentally open yourself to the,
right.
to the possibility of this kind of thing, then you might as well be playing with a Ouija board, because your door is open and something might walk through.
Right. Well, there's a difference between opening yourself up and opening yourself up to deception. You can have your eyes open and look and see what's going on around you. I mean, if you're sitting on your couch watching TV and a spirit pops up in front of you and you just happen to see it, that doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with you or that you did anything wrong.
It's right.
Just, it happens, you know, and that kind of stuff happens.
Right. If you, but on the other hand, if you're sitting there in a state of great concentration, trying to make contact with some kind of entity from beyond, that's an open door.
That's an open door. That's where I would draw the line. Yeah, and that's where Scripture draws the line. So, I mean, that's just that's one element right there.
Do you believe that people are possessed?
The Bible is, it talks about possession in a number of ways. It says you can be possessed by devils, but it also uses the term evil spirit, unclean spirit, familiar spirit, and a couple of others. Now, my question is, why were these authors, many of them the same authors, using different terms for different types of spirits to describe possession? That is saying that it's possible for people to get possessed by a deceased person.
All right. On that note, hold it right there, because I feel it too. The whole thing is written on the wind. And some tablets somewhere, I think, too.
Love is all around me, and so the feeling grows.
Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from March 23rd, 2000. Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from March 23rd, 2000.
Anyway, we'll be right back. Once again, John Myler, who has written a book called Aliens in the Bible. The link to his site is on my site right now, www.artbell.com. Just go down to the name John Myler, and you can go over and look at his site. John, you know, again, a lot of Christians would say somebody who writes a book called Aliens in the Bible is committing blasphemy, and why it's just, you know, it's ridiculous, and
I have heard that, and I've gotten some flack over it. But
have you? I bet you have.
Yeah. Consider this: 39 people killed themselves last year because they believed that they were on a rendezvous with alien beings.
How do you know they weren't?
Well, I'm sure they were, but they were not the kind of kind, nice, sweet, gentle aliens that they would have thought.
You refer, of course, to the Heaven's Gate thing, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and they indeed thought they were going to. It had something. The marker, they said, was the comet, but they expected to end up on an alien ship.
Yeah.
I believe is what's correct.
Hiding behind the comet or something.
Yeah. Well. Or what? Wherever. Actually, toward the end, they said, well, even though there may not be a so-called companion, it doesn't matter. That the comet itself is the sign. And so, you know, I saw the videos, and they were all happy, happy, happy. They were ready to go. They said they were looking forward to it, really at ease, and looking forward to the trip and graduating Schoolhouse Earth and all the rest of it.
Yes, and, you know, this is kind of like this inner drive that I have, because I just feel that the Christian community needs to assert this question. And you really touched on a key topic when you mentioned, how are you going to be able to tell whether something is, you know, trying to deceive you or not?
And, yes.
There's something that I've been seeing in this whole phenomenon, a message that I've been hearing over and over through people that say they channel these beings and such and so forth. There's two main messages. One is, these beings planted humanity here on this earth. That's message number one.
Right.
Message number two is, they're going to return soon, and when they do, they're going to bring humanity into a new age of enlightenment.
Or come back for the harvest.
Yeah. Now, see, what does the Bible say about that? First of all, Genesis 1 clearly indicates that the same God who said, let there be light, is the same one that planted humanity on the earth. Elohim is a plural word, and I've heard from, like, say, Zachariah Sitchin and others, that they try to take that word and they turn it into angels, and that there's angelic beings that put life here on earth. But that word is plural because it's denoting Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. So there should be no confusion about that.
But wouldn't, to us, to whatever we were, if you toy with the concept in 2001, for example, that there was intervention by an alien species of some sort, that there had, in fact, can it go together? In other words, could there have been creation and then intervention at some point? Have you considered that?
Well, Scripture is clear when it says God created man and breathed life into him.
Yes.
Now, there's obviously been beings coming here and fiddling with people, but the ones that are mentioned in Scripture are the not good ones. Genesis chapter 6, for instance, talks about fallen angels that came to earth and mated with humans, and they really screwed up the planet.
The Nephilim, right?
Yeah, apparently they convinced everybody they were, but they were evil to the core to such a degree that God destroyed the entire planet as a result in the flood of Noah.
In the flood of Noah, yes.
Yeah, and Jesus said that we're going to have a return to the days of the flood of, or a return to the days of Noah, when that kind of stuff was happening. Matthew 24:15 and Luke 21:24 both indicate that we're going to see a return to that, that these beings are going to return to this world. And it marries right in with this concept that they are our creators. They're going to try to claim the title of God. And number one, that's blasphemy. Big, heavy, ugly word, but that's what you call it. When you're jumping up and saying you're God, that's blasphemy. And number two, they're trying to say that they're going to be the ones that are going to take the credit for humanity evolving into this new age of enlightenment.
Well, question for you, John. If such a creature were to come down in a ship, land, claim to be God, and appear to have godlike powers, how many people now on Earth, 6 billion plus, percentage-wise, do you think would buy it?
A lot, if they brought with them, say, genetic enhancements,
sure,
amazing technology.
Better color TV, whatever.
Oh, yeah. Think about technology that would be so advanced that if you integrated it into the human body, you would be telepathic and smarter than Einstein and more creative than Mozart and Picasso.
Pretty godlike.
Everybody would want that, and you hit the point right there, godlike. They will evolve us into gods. This is their message, and it's the same message that Satan gave Eve in the garden. Eat this, and you will be like God. Same temptation. And it's so obvious, and yet I hear it so often from people that are involved in this kind of phenomenon. And it wouldn't surprise me in the least if when these beings do show up, which I believe they will very soon, that this is what they're going to be. They're going to be here. They're going to be offering us all kinds of wonderful things. And it's going to be so good that people are not going to think that there's anything that could possibly be wrong with them. And yet there's something wrong with that. It doesn't line up with within Scripture.
John, have you ever heard me interview Major Ed Dames?
I am sorry to say that I haven't.
You haven't.
I've been studying and studying all these different authors.
Yes, he is a remote viewer.
Okay.
All right.
I've heard about that.
I'm going to have him on. I'm also going to have Ingo Swann on. These are very famous remote
I've
viewers.
I've heard of Ingo Swann.
Ingo, in fact, is the originator of the whole remote viewing thing.
Yeah.
Ed Dames was in the military remote viewing program. Now, Ed undertook as a project remote viewing Satan.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
You know, that's what I said, too. Oh, boy. Not such a bright idea. And, you know, I said, are you sure you want to do this? And he said, yes. And I don't think he's ever been the same since. Now,
well, he can get himself fixed really quick if he does one simple thing.
Yes. Let me just continue a little with what he said.
Okay.
He actually encountered Satan in Satan's, what he called, Satan's war room.
Okay.
The entity, he said, Satan, is real.
Mm-hmm.
And that evil is being consistently planned. Now, at one point, Satan turned and saw his presence, or felt his presence. And I thought that was a really, 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 really scary project.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure once you've had that encounter that you come out the same way.
Yeah. Well, you see, I've known people that have been plagued with demonic entities, and it's really not all the bells and whistles that you see in movies like The Exorcist. All it takes is a genuine faith in Jesus, and you'd be amazed at the kind of things that you would see in, you know, what you would consider an average church when it comes to demonic possession and deliverance from that kind of stuff.
Did you ever hear me interview Father Malachi Martin?
No, I haven't.
That's quite all right. He was the man after whom the movie The Exorcist was modeled.
Mm-hmm.
Father Martin has now passed on. As a matter of fact, I'm going to repeat on Sunday an interview I did with Father Martin.
Mm-hmm.
But he described in some great graphic detail many of the exorcisms that he has performed.
Yes.
And let me tell you, it was frightening stuff. I mean, for example, he would tell me that there have been priests who have died in the course of trying to get a demon from somebody. And he's seen them die.
Yeah.
And he's felt close to that himself. In other words, it's a battle that you just cannot imagine. It's such a battle.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen that up close and personal.
You have?
Yes, and let me just say that for those priests that died, to die in Christ is gain, so they're doing all right. Maybe they lost the battle over their physical body, but they're doing just fine. And, you know, it is a real thing that there's some serious stuff going on out there. And when you do get close to it, when it starts touching home, I mean, that personally, that is what brought me to Jesus, because I was really deeply heavy involved in a lot of New Agey things, Ouija boards and channeling and all that stuff. And
oh,
I actually lured this kind of stuff into my life.
Oh,
and because of that was part of my personal testimony, and it does get a great deal personal, but I'll just say that much, that there was some demonic stuff there, and it revealed itself to me, and it was scary as hell. But
I actually want to hear a little bit about this.
Well,
I didn't know you had this background.
Well, yeah, I used to really be heavy into the New Age type stuff. And
like Ouija boards.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Ouija boards honestly scare me. I had one experience. I won't talk about it.
Well, so, see, that's part of it. I had an interest in it. Actually, I didn't think it would work. And me and another friend of mine got together, and we were playing with one, thinking, oh, we'll just talk to an alien from another world or an angel in heaven.
Yes.
And satanic phrases started coming out of this thing, and I took my hands off it. I looked at my friend. I said, look, you believe in God. I believe in God. Why is this thing saying all this garbage? And we were, like, looking at each other puzzled, and we figured we'd just give it another shot, and we kept doing it. And the darker it got, the later in the evening it got, the faster this thing would zip around, and then all these satanic things would come out. And, you know, Lord had great mercy on me, because I did many things and dabbled in a lot of stuff, and I'm sure I had demonic influences all around me up until the Lord delivered me. But, yeah, that was a real eye-opener, all of those things that were coming about from that Ouija board.
Well, all right. I had no idea you had that kind of background. Interesting. The world, Christianity is not the majority belief in the world, right?
Well, as far as religion would go,
I would
say it is.
Now,
how many people actually believe? Well, the Bible itself says it's the straight and narrow, so therefore not very many people.
It's an awful lot of Buddhists and, you know, other religions.
I know it's growing by leaps and bounds.
Christianity?
Thousands of people are coming to Jesus every year.
Christianity is growing by leaps and bounds?
Oh, yes.
While the others are shrinking?
Yeah. A lot of it is
are you sure about that, John?
I am 100% positive about that. That can be looked up.
Well, I didn't know there was that much rice in the world.
Oh, yeah, especially in your country. Like China is sweeping China right now, even in the face of persecution, where you have Christians getting killed left and right for their faith. And actually, since they have opened their doors up and decided to allow this religion in, it's been sweeping throughout Russia and all over the world, unlike ever before.
What happens to those who have not received the word? Now, they might live and work and love and die without ever having the Christian word at all. I lived on the island of Okinawa, and they weren't Christians at all. They believed in, they worshipped their ancestors.
Mm.
That was their religion.
Well, one thing you can be sure of is that God is a God of mercy. And the Bible also says that planted within the heart of every human being is a certain knowledge about God. And, you know, let me just tell you this one quick story. There was a story about a missionary who had been traveling, and he was on some remote island. And he was just wandering through the jungle there looking for the nearest village and saw this man praying in English at some rock out there in the middle of nowhere. And so he started talking to the guy. It turns out the guy didn't know how to speak in English. He was speaking in tongues as he was praying. And that this guy was leaving his village to pray to a one God that he knew was a true God. And it wasn't anything to do with any of the people in his village. And this was a village where there was no gospel. So in summary, I would say that for a people that do not know God or do not have any knowledge of God, God will send somebody because he's a merciful God.
Will send somebody.
Yes, he will send somebody. He will rise up a prophet, as it says in Scripture.
All right. Reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
There appears to be strong evidence, John, that souls come back again and again and again. That it's not just one trip to Earth, but perhaps many. Now, most who believe in the Bible say that's baloney.
Mm-hmm. Well, I not only have an answer for that, but I have a possible explanation for all of the evidence that appears to support it. First of all, when you're looking at the Bible and trying to find reincarnation, you should start with Hebrews 9:27. Man is appointed to die only once, and then comes the judgment.
Right.
You can't get more clear than that.
Well, so, and yet the stories are, John, that once reincarnation actually was part of the Bible and was voted out by mere mortals, literally voted out. You know about that.
I would say that if it was voted out, it would have been under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And the reason I say that is because reincarnation goes against everything that Jesus taught. Consider this. Reincarnation is man's work, man's own work, and what he has to do in order to achieve oneness with God. The doctrine of the gospel says man in his own effort can do nothing. Man needs God to step down to his level. That's why God became a human being and came to us, to take us to him.
Then when a hypnotist regresses a patient back into a former life where the patient may begin to speak another language, may describe surroundings of another country, or even may be a different sex, what has the hypnotist run into, John?
Okay, well, now you're talking about hypnosis.
Yes, sir.
That's another bag right there. I've read a lot about it. The reason it's not valid in courts is because once you're under a deep state of hypnosis, you're highly you're suggestible to whatever is said to you. Let me give you an example. You're growing younger and younger and younger. You're in your womb. You're now out of your womb. You're flying backwards in time and time and time. Right there, you just made a suggestion. You're telling that person that they're flying backwards in time,
right,
whether they did or not. So, since memory is reconstructive itself, the mind has an amazing capacity to be able to create whatever you suggest to it. So, you can't really prove reincarnation with hypnosis, but there are other cases that are a lot more convincing than that, where people weren't under hypnosis, like kids in India. I mean, it's actually not very uncommon in India, and these kids are not undergoing hypnosis, and yet they're remembering facts about people that have been verified. That's a lot harder to discredit.
Yes, I agree with you, and so how do you?
How do you? Well, you remember what I said about ghosts.
Well, yes.
The possibility exists that people could get possessed by spirits of the deceased. So if that possibility exists, then the possibility must also exist that they contain the memories of people that are deceased.
They would have to be from hell, yes? Deceased from hell, not possessed by the remnant of somebody who's gone to heaven.
Yes. Well, now, see, it could be either or.
It could?
It could be. It could be a psychic phenomenon. Then again, it could be spiritual possession by an unclean spirit, as Scripture would call it. And they would misinterpret all of the thoughts and emotions and feelings, the personality of another person, as their own. And especially if it's young in life, when you're not really even fully developed yourself. Of course, you would think that, you know, you were somebody else.
All right. Hold on, John. Stay right there. We're at the bottom of the hour. John Myler is here, and he says they are here. And, in fact, the book he wrote is called Aliens in the Bible. You might want to check it out. It's kind of unusual.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from March 23rd, 2000.
Another cup of wine.
presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired March 23rd, 2000.
Did you ever listen to the words of this song? Girl, you got me thirsty for another cup of wine. You know what he means, right? Well, isn't that what got us into trouble in the first place? Some girl with an apple.
All the good love, when we're all alone, keep it up, girl.
Yep.
Yeah, you turn me on.
I think that was it. We're going to talk about the net and artificial intelligence, but I want to talk with John for a second about monsters. Monsters, John, like Bigfoot. You've heard of Bigfoot, right?
Mm-hmm.
I want you to hear something, John. Listen carefully to this now. This, by almost every Bigfoot expert I've ever talked to, is the legitimate sound recorded in the woods of Bigfoot. And it's a pretty freaky sound, but listen to this sound carefully for a second. Now, John, that's a monster.
Yeah, my dad and my uncle have heard that sound.
Really?
Yeah, they have their own story.
That's a monster. Now, what does your Bible tell you?
Okay.
This is.
Let's drop back to Genesis 6. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men and bare children to them, they became mighty men, which were of old, men of renown. Now, these were giants. And when we look in the fossil record, what do we see in common with all of these different fossils and stuff? We see huge things. We see giant lizards, giant bears, giant tigers, giant gorillas.
Right.
To me, that is a prime indication that somebody was fiddling with genetics, specifically those genes that have to do with giantism.
Somebody?
Somebody, yes, I call them the sons of God. I believe that they were fiddling with genetics also. And that they actually had a specific purpose with the Nephilim, that they wanted to conquer the world. So before they actually got to producing children that were giants, they probably experimented with nature. And now when you drop down to verse 11, it says, the earth was also corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. Now that was a violent time. And God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth.
Right.
There's an indication in the fossil record, and also right here what I just read, that all flesh may have been corrupted by this genetic experimentation that happened back then and probably still happening now. So when you think about that, there's a possibility that there could be numerous creatures that are running around that are products of genetic experimentation. Okay, let's see what this gene does. Let's see what that gene does. And the result is you get giant creatures. You get creatures that are part human, part ape. You get creatures that are El Chupacabras with supernatural power. A large range of things could be the result of that.
But see, we have a gazillion reports, for example, of the Chupacabra. We have hundreds of animals that have been autopsied, two fang marks in their neck, all the blood gone from their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Seemingly supernatural, but nobody has ever captured that I know of, although we have a couple of interesting pictures, a chupacabra.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like they're in a kind of a realm that's not fully physical.
Right. Well, see, these Nephilim may have been in that same category because it says these were men of renown, men that legends had been made after. And when you analyze, like, Norse mythology, Greek mythology, Sumerian theology, you find these beings that often had supernatural power. So when we're talking about genetic experimentation, we're also talking about the possibility that these beings could have had supernatural power. They were trying to create a genetically superior human being, superior in size, superior in strength, superior in intelligence, and possibly psychic power, the ability to do things with the mind.
Uh-huh.
And that's why I see this, you know, as a possibility that these monsters that we're seeing running around, you know, they're products of demonic beings coming down and fiddling with our life forms that we have here on Earth and coming up with all kinds of things and just turning them loose because they don't care. I mean, this is just their laboratory where the lab rats and they're here to just wreak havoc. So, I mean, that's how I come up with that conclusion.
Now, you've got a category called mythical creatures, like
right.
vampires and werewolves. Do you believe they are purely mythical, or do you think that there is or has been such a thing as a vampire? Because I've talked to them.
Well, they they begin as a myth, such as the legend of Dracula, for instance. It comes from Romania.
Vlad the Impaler.
Right, and from there, a lot of superstition, and you know, even people that took information from the Bible, saying that you know, actually in the those days, they considered these beings to be demons. This is just a specific name for a demon, but it starts as something real and then falls into legend. And then when people start to strongly believe in these things, well, then that opens up a door because there's beings out there waiting for an avenue in which to come in.
And so, voila,
and assume a role.
The monster from the id creates the reality.
Right. In and of itself, it's not real, but there's beings out there ready to assume that identity.
Well, to us, it would be as real is. I mean,
mm-hmm.
if an entity assumed the reality, or not reality, assumed the image that we had created over the years, finally as a myth, mm-hmm. so there might be a vampire. There might be a creature that lives only by taking the blood of the living.
Plus, you might want to consider what I wrote about thought forms and the power of thought to be able to generate energy that can do things, like the studies of thought forms and where they actually created a pseudo-entity. It didn't really exist.
Right.
This was done by the London Society for Psychical Research. They created a false entity called Philip that was actually able to move a table across a room.
Philip?
Nobody there. So,
how did they create the entity?
They created this fake being by gathering in a room and concentrating and talking and just talking about this person for years, for several years, and thinking about this person that never existed. And they had to actually research it to make sure that this person never existed. But they put a lot of intense mental effort into this.
Oh, and that's really very interesting.
And they actually created
Philip.
This being, yeah, Philip, that didn't really exist. And actually there's roots of this in Tibetan occultism. They call it a tulpa.
Except that there began then to be physical manifestations
mm-hmm.
of this creation of their minds?
Yes, of their minds.
By the way, it was only Philip, right? Not Philip and Terence, just Philip.
Yeah, there were others that came later, but Philip was the most successful.
I see, all right.
But the point I'm trying to make is, yes, the mind may be able to have a power to be able to initiate something like that, but once the energy is there and the doorway is open, there are beings out there that are waiting to assume that identity, and they may even be able to harness that energy. The case of Alexandra Neal, the lady, first lady to enter in Tibet and to study their practices,
right.
She apparently created this being as a tulpa, and it was actually physically seen by other people. But according to her experience, this being started to change and it became malevolent, became evil. It would attack her and stuff, and she actually had to go through these different rituals in order to defuse it. But to me, that's an indication that she may have initially created it, but something else came in later on and took that energy over.
Wow.
And the same could be said for legends like vampires and werewolves, where you have hundreds of people all believing in the same thing. So when energy is there, and then something just comes in and harnesses the energy, assumes the identity, and then takes it to the next step, feeds the fear, and then generates more fear, and then in return gets that energy. and strengthen.
So we are what we think, or we create what we think.
To a certain degree, yes. I do believe that the power of the mind, that there is something to that, but not so much so to rule out, you know, anything that would be contrary to Scripture.
John, have you ever seen a movie called At Play in the Fields of the Lord?
No, I have not.
No, huh? It was a, if you ever get the opportunity, go rent it and see it and give me your reaction. It's about some missionaries that go down into the Amazon, and they encounter a tribe that, of course, has never met a modern man before, and they have a lot of things they believe in which don't include the God we know.
Mm-hmm.
And so they begin to try to change them. What they do in the end is utterly destroy them, bringing disease, flu, things that this tribe has never encountered before, and so they end up killing them, and toward the end they find out they really didn't convert them anyway.
Mm.
You know, just rice and trinkets and toys, and for whatever reason, you know, the tribe's people would, you know, cotton to these things and want them, of course, and so they just sort of put on a face and went through the ritual, as it were, but they didn't believe a thing, and then the poor people in the end ended up dying, I think, of disease brought in. How do you feel about that kind of evangelism?
I think that they went about it all wrong.
What's the right way?
Just as an initial reaction, I would say that as a missionary, they went about it all wrong. When you're initiating first contact with a people that have never heard about the Lord, they need to know very fundamental things in such a way that, I mean, that it won't destroy them, obviously. I mean, that's not God's way of doing things. God brings salvation. He doesn't bring destruction.
Oh, I don't know, John. There's an awful lot of wars going on, and
a lot of wars go on in the name of religion, but
name of God
barely have anything to do with God.
Yeah, but every side, even Saddam Hussein. You remember when he talked about the mother of all battles and everything? It was God on his side.
Well, consider that Saddam Hussein is a Muslim, and the basis of the Muslim religion is war. That is not the basis of what Christ taught. Christ taught love your enemies.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see how you can go and destroy a people when you believe that you should love your enemies.
Yeah, the Japanese were mainly Buddhists. They're thought to be pretty peaceful, but, you know, there was Pearl Harbor and all that.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, there's a lot of destruction done in the name of...
That's true, and I think that's because humanity is involved. As long as you're going to have people, you're going to have... mistakes. You're going to have things that just are not gone right. And it's a learning experience, especially for like a missionary that's in a situation like that. Man, I really have a heart for a person like that, because that's a tough job. I mean, you see these people and your heart cries out for them, and you want them to know that God actually came to earth as a human being and showed himself to humanity as a being who loves us and who's reaching out to us, and yet, you know, how do you do that without, you know, disrupting everything that's part of their life? Be a very, very difficult task.
John, what's you know what astral projection is, right?
Yeah.
The ability of some people to leave their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
I've done it once, John.
Yeah, you know, I heard about that.
Did you? You heard about it? Well, it did happen to me. It was brief. It was. I didn't volunteer for it. I didn't try to make it happen. It just happened.
Mm-hmm.
And others are able to leave their body as a practice.
Yeah.
Now, what is a person doing when they're doing that? I mean, where in the Bible is it covered that you can separate your soul from your body on a temporary basis?
Okay. Genesis 11 speaks about a time when all the people in the world spoke one language. And at that time, it says that decided to gather together and build this big tower. I assume it was a temple where they had their worship and religious practices.
Mm-hmm.
And then Scripture says that they were reaching to the heavens, and they were obtaining so much knowledge from this activity surrounding this tower that God actually came down and intervened. And this is the only time in the history of humanity where God has come down and said, man is obtaining too much knowledge, I got to put an end to it. Now, I'm the only one so far of that I know of that has come up with this bizarre theory, but I think that what they were doing is that during their rituals and stuff, they were taking a bunch of different types of drugs, which are always involved in different rituals and ancient religions.
Mm-hmm.
They discovered a side effect. They could leave their bodies. When they had that happen to them, they decided, wow, well, that was fantastic. So they incorporated it into their practice. Then they began they found out they could go out into outer space, and they were not hindered.
That's right.
And they were able to travel to other worlds and even see other worlds.
That's correct.
That's when they crossed the line, because that's when it would have become possible for them to travel into a glorified realm and even corrupt that realm, just as Satan corrupted Earth.
That's also correct.
So God put an end to that. But before they were stopped, I imagine they were obviously collecting information about stars, how the stars were positioned, where they went last time, so that they can continue.
In other words, they were learning too much.
This is where astrology comes from. And the fact that they attributed beings to stars is obvious. They saw beings there at these other planets, so they attributed beings to the stars. But they were within different... They were actually in the heavens, because it says they were reaching into the heavens. And nothing could be withheld from them.
Yeah, at the higher levels, there are people who can claim today they can do that.
Mm-hmm. And see, it's coming back. That ancient knowledge is coming back. And when you look in Scripture, you see all kinds of information about sorcery and magic, which I think, incidentally, all comes from astral projection. Astral projection is like a key. It unlocks that ability within...
Really?
Within the mind and within the spirit.
So it's a very dangerous thing from your point of view, right?
It is very dangerous.
Anyway, listen, John, your book,
mm-hmm.
Aliens in the Bible,
yeah.
is actually on the net, right?
Yes, it is.
So in other words, this is not a book someone has to go buy?
They can buy it if they want to read it in paper.
And if you have a computer, you actually are giving it to people for free.
Yeah, they can go there and read it for free. Yeah.
What made you do that?
God.
God,
and, you know,
good answer, I
people
guess.
People are going to say that I'm nuts, and I get people telling me I'm nuts because I believe God communicates things to me, but I think if they're going to say that, they're going to have to categorize every Christian into that same boat, because God speaks to me, and God speaks to anybody that says they have a relationship with Jesus. And
so,
I believe that God conveyed that to me, because I don't see how else I could do anything so nuts.
So God said, put it on the net.
For free.
For free.
That's right.
What do you think about artificial intelligence eventually attaining virtual human abilities? In other words, the recognition of self, that moment when we get a processor and storage
self-awareness.
Sufficient. Self-awareness, that's right.
Yes, I have a chapter devoted to artificial intelligence.
Yes.
And when you read in Revelation 13, 11 through 18, you find this beast, this being, whatever it is, evil,
yes.
Demands of humanity to create another being that is a sentient life form. So you're talking about a living being that is alive, that is man-made. To me, that is artificial intelligence. And what does this being do as soon as it is in place? It establishes world-dominating power, establishes a global economic system, something that I think the Internet is geared right up for, and then there's a mark that it establishes, like a global tracking system.
Yes.
In order to integrate people into
We're
this...
Coming
new,
up on that now, you know.
Mm-hmm, into this new consciousness. I believe that mark will be revolutionary computer technology.
And you're using this same eventual mark to get your word out, huh?
Isn't that interesting?
Isn't that interesting? All right, listen, you have been a fabulous guest. John, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me on.
I hope you sell lots of books and people go to the Internet and read away.
Okay, God bless you. I'll be praying for you.
I need it. Thank you. Good night.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from March 23rd, 2000. Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired March 23rd, 2000.
This is pretty seductive stuff if you listen closely. About to go into open lines. Anything you want to talk about? Big iceberg breaking off down there. Maybe the changing weather. Some of the news of the day. They canceled the thing down in Phoenix. And the Cavs are falling like dominoes in Oregon, but we don't know a whole lot about that. Anyway, it's good to have you here. We're going to be here throughout the next hour with anything you want to talk about. I'm Art Bell, and this, of course, is Coast to Coast AM, where we take unscreened calls. A rather dangerous thing to do, frankly, but we do it. We just pick up the next line that's ringing and proceed. It's a You never exactly tell what you're going to get. A lot of times, you get more than you bargained for. Let's see. Have I got this set up right? I think I do. In a moment, open lines coming up. There once were two rednecks named Bubba and Earl. Bubba and Earl were driving down the road drinking a couple of bottles of Bud. The passenger, Bubba, said, "Looky there, up ahead, Earl. It's the police. They've got a roadblock. We're going to get busted for drinking these here beers." Bubba said, "Don't worry." Earl said, "We'll just pull over, finish drinking these here beers, peel off the labels, stick them on our foreheads, and throw the bottles under the seat." "What fur?" said Bubba. "Just let me do the talking." Okay, said Earl. Well, they finished their beers, threw the empty bottles under the seat, and each put the label on their forehead. When they reached the police roadblock, the sheriff said, you boys been drinking? No, sir, said Earl. We're on the patch. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
Really?
Well, possibly.
Oh, possibly.
Yeah.
Okay.
In all probability, actually.
It's unbelievable. I don't know how many people die how many times to get through.
A few.
That's right.
Now, the first thing you should do is turn your radio off.
Okay.
It's carved in a tablet somewhere.
Actually, my TV.
Okay. Well, that's fine. That too.
Okay.
Shouldn't be watching TV and listening to the radio at the same time anyway.
No, I'm not.
Scramble your brain.
I'm not.
All right.
It's the news channel that has the radio on.
I see. All right. So anyway, surely you had a reason for calling.
This really is you. Pardon me. I sound like those people that call in.
Oh, God. You are one of those people that call in.
Well, I tell you, you were going to be my solution to sleeplessness. I turned in on the news one night, and I thought, well, this is real boring. This is great. All of this is commercials almost. And then...
Some people say that about me, too.
And then you start talking about chili and taking all that stuff. I thought, this guy's nuts.
About what now?
Eating chili.
Oh, chili.
Remember when that guy brought the chili over?
Yeah, actually... He used, in his chili, you see, he used this cayenne pepper that is rated in BTUs. I'm serious now. This was 95,000 BTU stuff in this chili.
Mm.
It's really a sad story that I don't want to roll over again, but you obviously heard it.
That was the first night.
That was the first night you heard me.
Yeah.
And you stayed around?
Yeah, to see if you got any more explosive stories like that.
It's only funny, believe me, in retrospect.
I'm sure it is. Yeah. I just couldn't believe it. I thought, you know, this man's not very bright, I don't think. Taking all that stuff on top of that, what is it with him? And then it was like you were a whole different person when I listened to more. I was like, I think he's just human, must be what it is.
I felt like a whole new person. Not much of what was in me, anyway. Enough of you. Anything else of great substance?
No, I just wanted to tell you that here I was trying to go to sleep by you. Now I can't go to sleep at night for wanting to listen to you.
That's nice. Thank you, dear.
You're welcome.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
See you later. That's one of the sadder experiences of my life that I don't care to repeat. And he gave us a whole... We have it stored in a bottle. You have to store it in a bottle. This cayenne stuff is so strong that you dare not even get a little bit of it on your hand or nose or, God help you, your eye or anything like that. I mean, this is dangerous stuff. Really dangerous stuff. And when you do use it in chili, you use like a lot of chili and about a half a teaspoon of this stuff. And even then, you're risking internal Armageddon. A wild card line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hey, Art.
Hello.
What you should do when you come back from the dead, or give us a message that you're giving back from the dead, is turn people's radios off.
If I come back from the dead, nobody's going to have to turn their radio off. I will smite their radios before they have a chance.
Exactly. That's the sign you need to give us that you're... still alive.
When I'm gone, though, you search the airwaves, and in between stations, you'll hear me in there screaming somewhere.
I like to...
Probably screaming from the fire, but screaming.
What I think would be really funny is for you to go over all the things, the different things that you've done to try to kill yourself.
Well, first of all, that's unfair, because I have not tried to kill myself. I have simply had a lot of close calls, but none of them were voluntary, I can assure you.
What I liked especially was the sleeping bag catching on fire.
yes, he's sleeping. I haven't, you know, I don't think I've told that story in a whole long time. But when I met my wife, there could have been no more romantic a setting than where we were. We spent the night in the desert in the open. And in a place near Las Vegas called Red Rock Canyon, which is spectacular. I don't know whether you've ever seen the Red Rock Canyon to the west of Las Vegas, but it is spectacular. And we found a spot, you know, out among the cactus and the rocks and the desert and the hills. And we laid out sleeping bags. No, let's be honest, sleeping bag. And started a little campfire to keep our feet warm. Well, as we were in the middle of really getting to know each other really well, she said, I believe first, my feet are hot. And to which I probably replied, yeah, I know, mine too. But they actually were hot. And so we looked down, attention drawn temporarily away from more interesting things, and God, it was on fire. Our sleeping bag was burning. And I mean, really, on fire. And so that motivated, you know, the adrenaline goes. And we put out the fire, standing on it, right? And this sucker really was on fire. And then resumed our former stance. And damn if the thing didn't catch it. You know, it just didn't get put out. It caught on fire again. And it really burned. So that was the experience that caller was referring to. On the international line, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Bell.
Hi.
How you doing today?
About just fine. Where are you?
It's Mike calling from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan.
All right.
How you doing tonight? I already asked you that. Sorry. Just a quick thought here. I was listening to Dr. Michio Kaku last week.
Yes.
And he was talking about internet progression.
That's correct, yes.
And I thought, you know, with all this internet stuff, the radio wave is really going to become a defunct thing.
I think that's probably right. But it's a long ways away. Internet radio is going to happen, but it hasn't happened yet.
So my thought on that is not only with when you look at the SETI project, not only do you have to search all these planets and galaxies, you have to hit that 200-year time frame perfectly.
Right.
So, I mean, it seems to me that it's almost an impossible task to find something unless it's a tremendous amount of luck.
Maybe eventually they will decide to announce themselves on the Internet. Had you thought of that? Wouldn't that be an effective thing to do?
It'd be effective as hell, but it'd be kind of hard to trust something like that. Unlike, you know, visual, you know, landing on top of the White House. Now, that's going to impress some people.
Might be something like www.werehere.com. Or I suppose it would have to be .org.
Yes. Another quick thing, when you have your guests' speakers on...
Or maybe it would be www.werehere.new.world.order.
Oh, lovely. That's just what we need to hear.
Yeah.
But one quick point, Art. When you have your guest speakers on, can you get the international line up and running for them to
No, because the international line is the line I use for guests, as you well know, so...
Oh, really? So that's why I can't get through when
That
I
is why you
again.
Cannot get through, that's right. But even though you're in Canada, you can use the east or west of the Rockies line up
there. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, I didn't know that.
Well, now you do.
Okay, well, I'm presently in Calgary. Which line would I be using? That's sort of... We're an hour from the Rockies. We're an hour east of the Rockies, so I might...
Well, that, you just answered your question.
Okay.
All right.
I wanted to know then.
All right, take care.
Thank you very much, my friend.
Right. One of the neatest trips I ever had was on the Canadian National Railroad. If you ever get a chance to do it, God, it's incredible. And I went from Vancouver to virtually Niagara Falls, Canadian side, and it was up. It was right up through the Canadian Rockies, and oh my, what a trip by rail. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hi.
Yes, Mr. Bell.
Yes.
This is Charlene from Alabama.
Charlene, you're going to have to lay into that phone and yell at me.
Is that better?
It is better.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I was listening to your guest you had last hour.
God, I like your accent.
Well, thank you so much.
Did you ever see a show called Grace Under Fire?
Yes.
You kind of sound like Grace Kelly.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
I would try desperately to get through. I wanted to ask this gentleman this question. Are you familiar with the fourth chapter of Malachi?
Not me.
Okay. Well, in the fourth chapter of Malachi in the Old Testament, it tells that Elijah will return. It's the fourth chapter. I think it's the fourth verse.
Okay.
You turn over to Matthew, the 17th chapter, and I believe it's the fourth. Let me flip these.
No, I don't allow a lot of Bible quoting here.
Anyway, well, what I was going to tell you, Jesus tells the disciples that Elijah's returned. Now, I wanted to put it out to your guest or to you. If there's no such thing as reincarnation in his religion, how does that work?
How did he get back? You know, that would have been an excellent question. Thank you very much. I don't have the slightest idea. I imagine he would have said that would not be reincarnation. That would be a direct act of God. God who can eventually resurrect all the dead. But I shouldn't try and answer for him. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Bell. How are you?
I'm okay.
I'm calling from Chicago.
Okay.
And my name is Art also.
All right, Art.
I'm originally from Maine, and I belong to the, I go to the MUFON conferences. When we have them, and I try to go to several, you know, on the East Coast.
Right.
You experienced one of the sightings yourself. I guess you and your wife, you had mentioned on the radio.
Oh yes.
In the desert, and it came above you, over your head. You explained.
Close enough, could have thrown a rock at it.
Now, you very serious about that?
Oh yes, very serious about that, sir.
Well, because you know, I've had similar things happen to me. I have some on film also. And how does somebody, I'd like to send you, you know, because I have a camcorder. How does somebody send you something so you could look at it? Because what I'm gonna send you, you're gonna really flip out.
Like what? What do you have?
I have a real glowing disc over a tree, and I'm no more than maybe 50 yards from this. And I was with a friend of mine. You can hear both of us talking because we were out sighting.
All right, sold. Now, here's the deal. Number one, you've got this on videotape, right?
I have several of them, yes.
Okay, I have the ability to take single shots, you know, snappy shots.
Okay.
And send them to my website. So if you send this to me, do you hereby give me permission to take a couple of stills and put them up on the web?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
All right, then, do you have a pencil and a paper?
I have one right here.
Send it to Art Bell.
Okay.
That's me. Mm-hmm. P.O. Box 4755.
4755.
In Pahrump.
How do you spell that?
You don't... Let me hear you try.
Say it again, then.
Pahrump.
P-R-U-M-P.
Boy, you went out of here with a $100 question. All right, no, it's P as in Paul, A-H... R-U-M-P.
P-A-H-R-U-M-P?
That's right.
And that's in Nevada?
It is indeed. And the zip code is 89041.
Yeah. And I'm going to tell you something, Mr. Bell. When you see this, I went 3 years ago to this MUFON conference, and I showed just one of the films because, you know, I have this camcorder that you can see it after you play it.
Sure.
And this feature, and one of the guys there, one of the speakers there, wanted to buy it from me. And I wasn't interested in selling it because I thought he was a phony himself. But, you know, and a lot of the people that go there, you know, they're just, some of them are curious, some of them are for real. And then you have a small percentage that are just, you know, just want to make a name for themselves.
Yep.
But I'm going to send it to you. And I do appreciate you being on the radio and having some of the nicest guests, some of the most interesting subjects, and I thank God that you're on there.
Well, I'm not sure it's his doings, but I appreciate your call, sir. Thank you.
Okay. And you have a nice day.
You too. Take care.
Okay.
All right. Here we go. West of the Rockies, you are on the air. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Art.
Yes.
I would like to ask you a question. I missed a tiny bit of the show. Excuse me. So I did not hear if you said if you ever located Linda.
Not yet. I called Linda again today, and she wasn't there. I think Linda's on her way to Oregon. Actually, she's probably there by now. Now, I'm only guessing, but it's a pretty strong guess. I know she was really, really very excited about the news from Oregon based on an interview she did. So.
Right. I don't know if I were her. I think I'd be worried.
Well, look, she's a very experienced investigator in these things.
True.
Yeah, she really knows what she's doing, so I think she'll be all right. One thing's for sure, if she gets to the bottom of it, we're going to hear about it right here. You know
all
that.
Right.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, you take care.
You too.
Bye. Yeah. She knows what she's been doing, and that's her business. She's been doing it for a lot of years, cattle mutilations and such. I don't know that that's where she is, but she might be.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from March 23rd, 2000. Art Bell, Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from March 23rd, 2000.
By the way, if you're in Astoria, Oregon, you can now hear us on KAST 1370 on the dial in Astoria. They begin the program in the third hour. So, if you're listening in Astoria, you should call them up and say, why not begin in the first hour? But we're glad to have them on board. That's KAST in Astoria, Oregon, a brand new affiliate. I really should have mentioned that a little earlier, but mention it now, I did. I'm Art Bell, and we're in open lines. Anything you want to talk about is certainly fair game. Coming right up. Here we go again. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Oh, Art.
Hello.
Far out, man. I can't believe I got through there.
A lot of people say that.
Waiter, that'll be enough ice. Come back in about 10 years. Holy cow. Great show tonight.
Thank you.
Yeah. My whole church has been praying for you.
I need it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you got the first church of the terminally bewildered behind you.
The first church of the terminally bewildered.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, there's some power.
Yep. Yeah, I was hoping I could get through to John. I wanted to give him the answer to the riddle of Revelation.
And that is?
Actually, Art, you supplied me with the answer, and I struggled with it with Sean Morton, too, and neither one of us could figure out what it meant. And then you had a guest on one night that gave me the answer magically.
And that was?
It gives us a timeline for an astral impact, and I also think this is the basis for the famous Nostradamus quatrain, 72, about the King of Terror.
Yeah, but that was supposed to, it should have already happened.
Well, yeah, I know. That
is, unless the calendars, of course.
Exactly, and it might be screwed up, because right about the time Revelation was written, they toyed around with the calendar. I forgot, Pope Gregory. We went from the Gregorian calendar, or we're on the Gregorian calendar now, I'm not sure, but somehow they got it messed up.
Well, we'll find out all at once. I mean, there'd barely be time to look up and say, oh, Nostradamus was... And, you know, you wouldn't even get the right part out.
Absolutely. Well, you want to hear the riddle?
Sure.
Okay. It's Revelation chapter 9, verses 1 through 11. John sees a star fall from the sky. Now, the word star is capitalized because it's personified. The star hits the earth,
yes,
opens up the abyss. Out of the abyss come locusts. Now, the locusts have five characteristics. They have teeth of a lion, hair like a woman, scales on their chest, a scorpion sting, and the face of a man, body of a horse. That's our timeline right there. Teeth of a lion, that's Leo. Hair like a woman, that's Virgo. Scales on their chest, that's Libra. A scorpion tail is obviously Scorpio. And body of a horse, face of a man, is Sagittarius. So we've got five consecutive months there, beginning July 23rd and ending on December 21st. So there's a timeline. Now, the word star is capitalized in some Bible. That's because it's personified. And the locusts have a king over them. And his name in Hebrew is Abaddon. Translated into Greek is Apollyon, and finally into English, Apollo. That is what I struggled with for the longest time. Why was a Greek god mentioned in the Bible? It just didn't make sense. And then, lo and behold, one night you had on an astronomer who was talking about Earth-crossing asteroids.
That's right.
And he gave out the three categories, and one of them was Apollo. One of the three Earth-crossing asteroid categories is Apollo. And in that range of asteroids, there is an actual asteroid named Apollo.
Apollo. He's the one.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So, you've got a timeline in terms of months, but what about year?
Well, see, if Nostradamus was right, if the years are changed,
yes,
and we're further ahead in time, right?
Yes.
So, I don't know. I'm still struggling with that part.
All right. Well, then, for about half the year, you're comfortable, and half the year, you're nervous.
Well, last year, I was nervous.
Yeah.
Because I hadn't figured this out yet. All I had was the timeline. And then this was around last Christmas when you had this guest on who was
remember. Thank you very much for the call. Yeah. That's the way it would happen. Most of these near-Earth or Earth-crossing, Earth-orbit-crossing pieces of rock that could be ELEs. Remember ELE? ELE, remember? Extinction level event. These big rocks that could crash into us. Most of them we have not categorized. We don't even know about them. They found one the other day, as a matter of fact, that will pass about four times the distance of the moon from Earth. Now, that's pretty close. That's pretty close, folks. And one of these days, one of them's going to hit us. And we're not going to know about it. The one that gets you is the one that you don't see coming. And there's good grounds for that old saying, you know, you don't see it coming, the one that gets you. Well, you don't. It's headed straight in, and heck, we barely notice the ones that manage to catch the sun at enough of an angle, much less the ones that are coming straight at us. So probably we'd have enough time to notice that something was happening in the sky, and we'd look up and say, what the hell's, you know, and all conversation would end. West of the Rockies, you're on the air.
Hi, Susan calling from New Mexico. Just wanted to tell you where Linda Moulton Howe is.
Where?
She's at the Aztec UFO conference.
Oh, no kidding.
Yes, I went to her book signing tonight.
Well, thank you. Oh, thank you. I was a little concerned about Linda because she didn't tell me she was going. Or maybe she did, and I said, Linda, can you report from New Mexico? By God, she did tell me. And
mm-hmm.
and but then she couldn't get information because she said there was a gag order on what's going on up
That's
in Oregon.
That's what she said tonight.
She said that too tonight?
Yeah.
Did she talk much about it?
Yes, we went through crop mutilations, and we were talking about crop circles. Mutilations and the crop circles.
Uh-huh.
And alternative realities and string theories and so on. We were talking about a lot. It was a tremendous book signing and a tremendous presentation. And she's the principal speaker on Saturday.
You know, I really should have remembered that because she promoed that on the air when she was on last week. And
mm-hmm.
and somehow or another, it just blew right out of my mind. And because she was gone and didn't call me the following day, I thought, man, she's on the way to Oregon. But no.
She might be going after, you know, after the conference. I really don't know.
Could be. It'd be an easy move.
And the other thing I wanted to talk to you about is I also lived in Media, Pennsylvania.
You did?
Yeah, on Orange Street.
I went to Rose Tree Elementary.
Mm-hmm. I was an adult when I lived there, back in the early 80s. But the last time I visited, the trolley was still running.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to go back.
Yeah. It's still a nice town.
Cool.
And,
that's nice to know.
And you're the best thing since Long John Neville.
thank you, dear.
Okay.
Take care. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
How are we doing? All right.
We are, as the doctor would say, we are fine.
I've been traveling a lot, so I haven't caught every night. Does Gary North come on this year to apologize for his scare tactics?
No, and he doesn't apologize for what he said. You know, Gary North warned people of the possibility of a disaster, and there could have been a disaster. They spent... And really, people ought to be thanking Gary North and people like him, because $250 billion was spent, and it worked.
Well,
now, if there weren't people out there screaming that a big problem was on the way, what do you think would happen?
Well, I think probably the same thing happened in China and Russia and every place else where they didn't do anything. And it worked.
Well, you know, their computers are pretty backward compared to what we've got here, and I guess you can say that Y2K was a non-event, and certainly in some respects it was. But it would have been an event in this country, believe me, had they not spent the money. So I guess you could say Gary should call and apologize for scaring people. But if it hadn't been for the Gary Norths, the Ed Yordans, and, frankly, people even at the Senate level, you may recall, screaming and yelling about what was coming if we don't move fast, something would have occurred. So there's several ways of looking at it, and I really don't think Gary feels apologetic about warning people about what would have happened. He was on that very early. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
I was thinking about what you all said about looking for a sign.
Yes.
Don't you see signs all around you all the time? Look at the signs of you being saved from all sorts of things.
Well, there is that, I suppose. But what if I walk in front of an 18-wheeler tomorrow?
And
get smushed.
And?
Die.
Huh?
Die.
Yeah. Things die.
Right.
People die.
Right.
But your spirit lives on.
I mean, all kinds of things I guess you could think of as a sign, but you could also just think of them as things that happen to you in life. Stuff happens, you know?
Oh, stuff happens, definitely. But and he was right about this. God is love. And that love that you feel for others and that moves you to help others and that moves you to be compassionate to others.
Right.
That has a source. It has a meaning.
As does the source of evil in men.
Well, that's what that free will piece was. But look around you for signs. I mean, flex your hand. How can you do that? Isn't that cool? Isn't that a miracle?
Well, I'm too used to it to think of it as a miracle. Now, my hand had been unflexible for all my life, and suddenly I could flex it. That would be a miracle.
See, that's the thing. God has put signs all around you. There's signs everywhere. So this sign is, look, take a look around. And the thing is, I got to throw in one more thing here.
Sure.
He was talking about, I came in the middle, so sorry if I'm misinterpreting, but they were talking about the Pope as being an intermediary.
He was saying, no.
No, the Pope,
the Pope is no more of an intermediary to God than you or I.
Right, and he never claims to be. He's the teacher, he's the leader of a church. All churches have leaders and teachers.
Wait a minute. The Pope, words that the Pope says, certain words the Pope says, are not from the human man. They are words from God. They are absolutes.
No.
I think a Catholic would tell you that is
true.
I am
Catholic.
Well, then tell me, it's true.
No, it's not. He is inspired by God. He is led by God. He is
not
God.
You mean there are not certain times when he speaks when it is more than just a human man speaking?
No.
Message-wise? No?
No. He's a human man. He's just a guy. But he's the best we could do. He's the best spiritual leader we could find. He has the most knowledge. He has the most of the Holy Spirit involved in him. He's the best we could find. He's the best that we were led by the Holy Spirit to believe should be our leader and our teacher. But he's a guy. He's going to die.
Yeah, unfortunately, fairly soon.
But, he does his best. It's not...
You got to give it to the guy. Boy, he's really hanging in there.
He really is.
So frail, and yet he still makes trips.
And he listens to God with all his heart.
Dangerous trips, I might add, on top of that.
Yeah. And, Elijah?
Yes.
Elijah did come back. Remember when they were on the mount?
Yeah.
Jesus and Elijah and Moses?
Mm-hmm.
And Peter says, let's build three tents to show that Jesus was not Elijah.
Right.
Yeah, Elijah came back. Elijah's around. God can pull him up anytime he wants.
All right. Thanks for the call.
And God loves you.
Oh, I hope so.
You know it.
I don't know how, but I hope so. Take care. First time caller line, you're on the air.
Hello. This is Starwalker from the Land of Enchantment.
Starwalker?
Yes.
From New Mexico.
Yes, you got it.
Okay.
Quick note on the confusion over Nostradamus, the Sept, the seventh month.
Yes.
The originally September was the seventh month. October was the eighth month. And then Julius Caesar, being the megalomaniac he is, shoved a month into the middle of the calendar and called it Julius July. And then Augustus Caesar followed and made August his month, which shoved September, October, November back two digits.
Boy, those were egotistical suckers, weren't they?
Yeah, but that's how the...
Messing with a calendar like that. But what about the year part of it? That's really important.
Right, but that's how the Latin calendar, the Latin-based names of the months, still held, being September, being Sept, 7, October, Oct, 8.
Right.
Your caller was interesting. I had a similar experience. I was heavily into the occult and had a conversion experience myself. And I want to throw you a little curveball on that because, to my knowledge, this hasn't been mentioned when possession has been talked about on your show. Malachi Martin mentioned the experience of being perfectly possessed.
Yes.
The higher order, deceptive spirits, are actually religious spirits. The higher you go in the hierarchy of the deceptive spirits, the more they mimic the true spirits. So the common impression of demons and possessing spirits being really like Darth Vader is very misleading because the higher order spirits appear as religious spirits.
We are going to replay this Sunday a program with Malachi Martin that a lot of people have never heard, one in which Ed Dames came on with Malachi Martin.
Fantastic.
That'll be this coming Sunday.
Well, I was possessed by a religious spirit for 7 years. I was a Christian minister, and I didn't realize I was possessed by a religious spirit until I tried to leave the church and had to go through, you know, a series of deprogramming experiences to depossess myself of the religious spirit.
And what kind of spirit, pray tell, was
it? It was a born-again Christian religious spirit. And that possession was...
You mean you had to be exorcised of your born-againness?
That's right. I had to exorcise myself by going to the other extreme and following a shamanic path and really coming back home to myself and finding my own mind again.
You know what a lot of Christians would say now, right?
That's why I was saying I'm going to throw you a curveball.
Huh. You can't throw
this
me.
It's never been mentioned on your show.
I've had every pitch that has ever been thrown, sir.
Yeah.
But I do appreciate the toss. Listen, we're out of time. Program is over. So tell everybody out there, all across the world, good night.
Have a fantastic millennium and sleep well.
Take care, my friend. Good night. Okay, that's it. Again, I remind you, next week, I'm not going to be here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I'm going to be here Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Good night.